Well, the first thing that puzzles me...
Can I be heard all right?
Yes, I'm sure you can. The first thing that puzzles me a bit is that your Votes for Women book doesn't fit in with your other books. I mean, in the sense that your other books are largely about monarchy or high politics, really. And this one's very much about anti-high politics, isn't it? I mean, it's about a popular movement, in a way.
Yeah.
Why did you ever write it? Whatever started you off?
In those days, I wrote a good deal for the Literary Supplement, and the editor, Arthur Cook, was always a close friend of mine, you see. And evidently what happened was that Charles Monteith, who was a partner in Faber's, was looking round for... I don't think he was very high up in the firm, but you know, looking around for sort of possible subjects. And he it was who thought of suffragettes and asked Arthur whether he knew of anyone who might be prepared to write an account of them, you see. And that was really what started the whole thing. I think I decided to do it. I was interested in it, of course, from the Liberal Party point of view, the Mr. Asquith and Liberal government and all that.
Yes.
And I was also interested in what I think is the dullest part of the book, which is the history, particularly of the 19th century, the earlier part of it, which was much more the period I was interested in and so on. But that's really... how it began.
Why did Charles Monteith actually want a book on it? Just because he thought it was an interesting movement?
That's right, yes. And there had, I think, till then, been nothing really that I knew of much on the movement. There were plenty from those who took part in it.
That's right, there was nothing. I mean, yours is the first thing to get the grammar right, so to speak, I mean, to get the thing started. There was Sylvia Pankhurst's suffragette movement. And there was Ray Straitch's The Cause, and both those people were participants in the movement.
Yes.
So you're the first outsider, really. You were an outsider, were you, in every way? I mean, you didn't have a parent or anything who was involved or anything
No, I didn't. No.
So you're the first outsider, really, to come at it. And outsiders are really rather scarce in writing about the history of feminism, generally, I think. Anyway, you decided to do it. So how did you set about it? I mean, did you actually talk to anybody, you know, to start off with and ask for guidance, or did you really start off by reading periodicals and biographies and things like that first?
I don't think I went to anyone for guidance. I regard it as my Bible, Sylvia Pankhurst's book. And Christabel, I think, wrote a book as well, and Mrs. Pankhurst probably, but they were less dependable.
Really. That's right.
And I made up my mind that I wouldn't go and see any of these survivors, which was possibly a mistake and was criticised by one or two of them, of those who did survive, when the thing came out, you see, that if he'd gone to sea, it would have saved him from the rather unjust observations about the militants, which caused some troubles, you probably know.
I don't know about that, but I'd like to ask you later.
But I went to... see Mrs. Billington Greg, and I can't quite tell you why. I think because she had quarrelled with the Pankhursts and belonged in fact to the other body, I think, didn't she?
The Women's Freedom League.
That's right, the WFL.
Yes.
I don't know, I possibly knew she was father at the end, if I tell her, but it was an extremely interesting interview because she was marvellously loyal and she never said a thing against the against Pankhursts or the WSPU. Never at all. I particularly wanted to find out about Mrs. Despard, and she was very helpful on that. Of course, she knew and greatly admired her. Only she really became a very difficult woman to find out anything about. I think I've probably not done justice to her, you see.
Mrs. Billington Greig, in the end, did try to write a biography of her herself. There are a lot of manuscripts and things that are left
really?
In the Portsmouth Library. Yes. Anyway, so you went to her and really... Did you go to Wimbledon, where she lived?
That's then? Right.
Yes, because I've met her daughter there, you see.
Well, she and her husband were there.
I see. How did it go? I mean, you knocked on the door, presumably. What happened?
No, I think I must have written first.
Yes.
In fact, I'm sure I did. And I don't think they were tremendously objects of press attention, these survivors, then. And I think she was quite pleased to talk to me, which she did rather very openly.
Because you were very influenced by her view, really, weren't
you? I was,
you?
Yes.
What was it that attracted you, then, about her outlook on the movie?
She was wonderfully balanced. You know, as I tried to tell you, extraordinarily fair. And not in the least tilting against the other wing at all. Absolutely fair, I thought.
But was it clear to you that she really disagreed with them, despite that?
Oh, yes, it was, yes. Oh, yes, entirely. And I had known that, of course, from what I'd read.
Yes. Because, you see, in a way, she wasn't at all balanced at the time, in that she's highly rational in her objections and so on to the Pankhursts, but she's passionately anti against their methods and their style of leadership and so on. And causes no end of bad feeling at the time.
Yes, yes.
You know, I mean, she just was a firebrand, really.
Yes. She was called Billington, wasn't she?
Yes, Theresa Billington.
Hitched
yeah.
his name
That's
onto
right.
hers.
Yes. Anyway, you talked to her, and then you read her book, did you? Or had you read her book first?
I must have read her book first, I think.
The Militant
yes.
Suffrage Movement.
Yes.
Yes. Did that impress you, the book, do you remember?
It's made absolutely... my mind is like an empty sleet on the subject now, so it can't have...
Because, you see, one of the interesting things in your book is that you almost describe the Pankhursts as running a semi-fascist organisation. I mean, it has all these sort of overtones of fascism, in a way, about it.
Exactly.
The authoritarian and the violence and so on. And that's precisely Mrs. Billington Greig's view in her book.
Yes, no, that's absolutely correct. That's exactly what I felt.
Anyway, you went to see her, and then otherwise you didn't see other activists, really?
My wife has got a better memory than I have. She, I think, remembers this, that I must have gone to give a lecture to the surviving elements of the WFL.
Yes.
Whether it was called that then, I can't know.
I think it was, yes. Yes, unless you mean the Suffragette Fellowship, that's the
no.
girls.
No, this I think was the, it was quite a good attendance, somewhere in Kensington. And they gave me a very respectful and favourable hearing and all that. And then I said, was talking about the episode in Birmingham where they hammered on the roof when Asquith was speaking to her. And a woman then got up in the audience, and the chairwoman was elderly and but extremely nice, said perhaps you would sit down for a moment. And this was Miss Charlotte Marsh, who had in fact done all that banging on the roof and all that, you see, and she was really absolutely charming. She was very, very nice to look at, and, you know, absolutely believed that what they'd done was right, and completely confident, and she was very saddened when that book of mine came out, because she felt it didn't do justice to them. was still very fair, but and who did the Rugby Venus?
Oh, that was no, Mary Phillips, wasn't it?
Mary Phillips. She wouldn't have been still alive, would she then?
Yes, she died, I think, in the early 60s.
Because another occasion was when I went to the National Portrait Gallery while I was writing this book, and they got, I suppose they had the Rugby Venus out, and you know, various things, Mr. Pankhurst and so on. And I have a sort of idea that she was there, but that could be wrong.
She wrote her autobiography in the late 50s or early 60s.
Oh, did she?
Yes, called Laugh a Defiance.
Oh, yes, I think I've got that somewhere upstairs, yes.
Mm. Anyway, you did all your research. does it fit in with your attitudes to the Liberal Party? I mean, does the book fit into the history of you as a Liberal?
I think it possibly does. A sort of, rather two sides to it, really. The belief that women should, of course, have had the vote, and then this very narrow issue, which people find it difficult to understand, that if they had been given the vote, it would have definitely damaged the Liberal Party at that stage.
Yes.
Must have done.
Mm.
And I had two pieces of good fortune in that, for some reason, I knew that the Kensington Museum, the London Museum, had, I think, it was the archives of one of the WSBU companies, their papers on the West. And perhaps they are still there, aren't they?
Yes, they are. It's now the Museum of London, isn't it?
But the Museum of London, yes.
Mm.
And then the other piece of good fortune was that I was friendly at that time with Wadsworth, who was the editor of The Guardian. And he was one of the governors, or whatever it was called, of the Rylands Library in Manchester. And he was always slightly interested in these things. It was the most extraordinary thing, but if not an absolute mass, again, of the papers of one of the societies in Manchester, but simply shot their stuff at them. You see, probably now well catalogued and all that, but was in chaos. I don't think from recollection that was WSBU, but it was very well done in newspaper cuttings, which were, beautiful.
Pasting books.
Yes, exactly.
Mm.
And that was it. That was extremely useful to me.
You admire Asquith, do you? I mean, you always have.
Oh, yes, I've always been an ardent Asquith. Yes.
Because in a way, he's just not made to deal with the suffragettes, is he? I mean, everything the suffragettes do is guaranteed to bring out the worst in him. Or
that's absolutely right. Absolutely right.
I mean, he doesn't fit at all, does he, with them? And did you feel, in a way, when you were writing the book, that you were writing, to a certain extent, a sort of vindication of Asquith against them?
I think that's correct, a vindication of the delay by the Liberal government. Because, of course, some of them, whom I also greatly admire, like Edward Grey, was in, through his rather eccentric wife, was in favour. It was rather, and Lloyd George, I suppose, was tolerably in favour, but there was a great deal of opposition throughout the Liberal Party, really, and particularly from the question of the vote, of course. Votes for ladies, they used to say.
Yes, well, I mean, clearly there were very good reasons why the Asquith government didn't favour any sort of woman suffrage bill except an adult suffrage bill.
Yes.
And for various reasons they couldn't go for that early enough. But I mean, I did feel that there was a defence of Asquith in your book, which you don't get in any of the literature written by suffragettes themselves. I mean, you begin to try and understand both sides, whereas nobody previously had done so.
I think that the Home Secretaries, of course, Gladstone and McKenna, that once you get sort of caught up that kind of violence, what you remedy yourself becomes much less important. And I suppose looking back on it, those things were ghastly, like cat and mouse and forcible feeding and all that.
Yes. And one of the, I think you're really quite daring in the things you write, actually. I mean, I'd be very interested to know if you could, we could move on a bit to discuss the reception of the book, because you even say at one point that the police were justified in the way they manhandled the women or whatever in the Black Friday, I think it was called.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that I agree with your view, but it couldn't have been very acceptable to the surviving suffragettes at the time. Can you describe to me how the book was received when you wrote it?
Well, it sounds rather conceited to say this, and it's only through, really I haven't thought of the thing for 20 years, but through looking through that great tome I've got, say, over here, I was surprised to read the reviews, quite honestly. Only I don't know whether you should perhaps, but spare me rather than publicise this, but I was surprised how extremely good the reviews were.
Favourable, you mean?
Yes, and very flattering to me, really.
Mm.
I think
I was really wondering, you see, whether I...
...this, that when I'd finished this book, when I was in London, I generally bought the Standard, and I noticed they were serialising A Life of Edward VII. And I just wrote to the editor and said, I have more or less finished this book, and would you consider serialising it, you see? And he wrote back and said that he thought they would, but he noticed that I hadn't entered for their £5,000 book prize. Well, I didn't like to write back and say I'd never heard of this thing, which was the truth. And so I duly entered for this. And in fact, as you know, that I won the prize or whatever. But the reason for that, there's nothing to do with the excellence or otherwise my book, but really the Standard had wanted to find a novel which would be in some way comparable with Gone with the Wind, you see. That was that idea, that it would be publicized and then would sweep the country. Well, they read through all these things and they could see that there was nothing comparable to that. Then they thought, well, if we take this book of Fulford's, he'll win the prize and we'll take the serial rights, you see, and we shan't be out of pocket. And that, in fact, is what happened. I mean, it was extremely generous and welcome to me to get this prize, but it wasn't really terribly expensive for them to follow me, because they, I think they did 12 serial extracts and sold a lot of them to country papers and abroad, I think. And
so it suited both parties.
Yes, I suppose in a way all that sort of publicity didn't, you know, do the book very much good as regards being a serious book, which I like to think it was, or try to think it was.
Mm.
Possibly not very much good. I don't know at all. I think Faber's possibly were rather disappointed with the number they sold, you see. They put it into the Reader's Union.
That's my edition, actually.
Yes. And they've now, just this moment, reprinted it in themselves.
Have they?
Mm. And I tried to, you know, I think I wrote to you, didn't I, after your review in the Literary Supplement, and I wrote much on the same lines to them that it was really rather too bad to let these women get away with the whole thing. Well, now, what I marked here, which I thought would be of interest to you.
Yes.
Well, shall I read this out?
I do, yes.
Taken down.
Yes.
You know, he's sort of mildly flattering about me, useful information and sort of thing. But in my opinion, its main defects are three. First, there are many inaccuracies, some of which are important, leading Mr. Fulford into making grave charges against the combatants, which he certainly could not substantiate. Well, I don't know what the actual...
I don't know. No.
Secondly, there is at times a lack of proportion arising from the limited sources of information on which he's drawn for his facts. In particular, he seems to be quite unaware of the wide extent of the educational propaganda and the vast sums of money spent in promoting it by militants and non-militants alike. I think that's probably a fair point to say. And thirdly, many of his judgments are prejudiced by his obvious partisanship in favour of the Liberal government of the day. Gladstone in the 19th century, Asquith in the early years of the 20th, as Liberal Prime Ministers, must both bear a heavy responsibility for forcing women into revolutionary courses. Yet on occasions, Mr. Fulford does not even mention the provocation caused by their disingenuous political manoeuvres. These grave defects could have been guarded against and prevented if Mr. Fulford had seen fit to take the usual course of consulting some at least of the leading protagonists of the conflict who are alive today before committing himself finally to print. And then he quotes Bryan.
Interesting, yes.
But that's quite interesting, isn't it? I'll just snap the light on.
Did you actually, you didn't actually ever go and see Lord Philip Lawrence then?
I saw him afterwards, yes.
Did you?
We had a sort of absolute fiasco of, couldn't have been TV, no, it's been a radio talk, at which he was. And he was by then, of course, very old, really, and were one or two other survivors there. But it was rather, it was not a success at all.
What went wrong, actually?
Well, I remember that the producer, who was a very able BBC woman, was terribly depressing about the whole thing. These old veterans mumbling away, that sort of thing.
So his wife was Una Dugdale, wasn't she?
That's right, yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, he writes. Here's the Evening Standard, of course, puffing their prizeman, described it as a story of the squabbles, the eccentric leadership, the courage, the folly, and the zeal of the suffragettes. And then Victor Duval wrote to correct this, saying that only brilliant statesmanship could have guided the suffrage cause to victory.
Mm. Well, you see, in my view, it didn't ever succeed.
No, well, I think that's more or less true. Now, this is an interesting comment. This is Jill Craigie, who
Mrs. Michael Foot's wife.
Yes, writing in Tribune. By omitting to analyse the motives that led to militant action, he unwittingly belittles the suffragette movement. Mm. Now, I would think that a very fair and important criticism.
Do you really think so? See, I wanted to ask you now, what do you think about the book in retrospect? I mean, would you now write it differently, or what do you feel about it?
Well, I suppose we've had all the weight of these books on the other side, haven't we?
Mm. And did you feel, when you were writing it, that you were breaking an orthodoxy by defending Asquith, or was that in fact the orthodoxy at that time?
Breaking...
I mean, by defending Asquith against the WSPU, you'd now be unorthodox, really. I mean, that's not the orthodoxy. But I wondered whether, in fact, that was the orthodoxy at the time. What I'm saying is, did you feel you were breaking new ground in interpreting the WSPU in the way you did at the time?
I don't think I felt it was new ground, but it was what I believed.
Mm.
And that's not quite the same thing, really, is it?
Mm.
I did form a very poor opinion of them, partly because I think it was, I think it was clear that, you know, an awful lot of it was sex, really, sort of hysterical worship, Mrs. Pankhurst, and much worse, really, of Christabel. But of course, so much as gone their way since, hasn't it, that I mean, people tend to behave like that in the modern world. If you don't get your way, you're like the Irish.
Well, there's a direct continuity.
Or even Mr. Peter Hain, who, when you're lucky enough to get off, you then shriek the injustice of the legal system somewhat.
I rather agree, but I mean, you say you were well received generally by the reviewers, but what about the suffragettes themselves? And did you get any letters, the surviving suffragettes? Did you
now, that, of course, unfortunately, I cannot remember. Mm. That I know there was this case of Charlotte Marsh, who either met Sybil in King's Road or me, and I can't remember which. Who knows, said that she enjoyed the book, but it was a pity. It was a pity. What a pity. That sort of line.
Yes.
There was a woman called Enid Bach, whom was rather a friend of mine, and was a niece of
Mrs. Pankhurst.
Yes. And she was certainly indignant and certainly wrote to me. But, you know, someone I knew and perfectly acceptable. Wasn't offensive by any
matter. No, I see. She just expressed disagreement in a polite way.
Yes, exactly. As she would.
Mm.
But I don't think the more, you see, I suppose they hadn't very much platform in those days, had they?
No, much less than now, I agree.
Yes.
Did you get embroiled between Christabel and Sylvia?
No, I've always been very favourable to Sylvia and unfavourable to Christabel. And some busybody from America wrote to me the other day. I think I put the letter out to show you in the other room, probably. So, utterly illiterate woman. Why she wasted my time? I can't think. She spelled Christabel wrong. But she seemed, I suppose she had some gossip over there, and she said that she understood that Sylvia Pankhurst was highly indignant at my book. So I wrote back and said I should have been very startled if she had been, because it was uniformly favourable to her, really.
Yes. Mm.
But I could believe that Christabel by that time had, you know, gone in for some sense of religion.
Yes, she had. Yes.
And I don't think she showed any interest at all.
So you didn't, you see, one thing that I thought you might have felt inhibited by when you were writing it was the tremendous propensity the Pankhursts have for going to law, and they're always bringing lawsuits against people, and I wonder whether you felt in any way restrained.
No, I didn't know that, as I might have, but I certainly didn't.
Because they're always doing this sort of thing. I mean, during the movement onwards, they're always bringing actions to defend either their own names or Mrs. Pankhurst's name.
I never knew that.
And, you know, I don't know if you've come across David Mitchell, have you, the person who writes on woman suffrage a bit?
Yes, I've never met him, but I know his books. And
anyway, one may have different views about his writing, but he's constantly being plagued by attacks in the press and by attempts to restrain him and all sorts of things by surviving suffragettes even now.
Really?
Yes. I wondered whether really that...
No, I certainly never... There was nothing of that at all.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I remember that Wandsworth was interested in Richard Pankhurst, who was a son, as you know, of Sylvia.
That's right, yeah.
And I think I may have made some allusion to him. I was so amused she puts unmarried one son in Who's Who. In those days.
Yes. But in retrospect, you wouldn't really write it differently, or you would? What do you feel?
I don't think I would. I was, as I've said, influenced by such people as Mrs. Billington Gregg. I was very much influenced by the Strachys. They weren't really the WFL. They were
no, they were the National Union of Women's Suffrage
that's
Societies.
Right.
They're the
yes,
non-militants.
That's right. Yes.
When you say much influence, do you mean you talked to them or?
Yes, I did. Indeed.
Did you really?
Well, owing to you see being connected with Lytton Strachey, not that I ever tapped eyes on him that I know of, but continuing that work for several months, they were always very sympathetic, and very kind to me, and. There was one who was a governess, but I can't remember what her name was, who was extremely nice, and I met her at dinner. She was very interested in the whole thing. And I honestly, could I have met Ray Strachey?
Yes, I think you could, yes. Well, she died in 1940.
No, I did not.
No. You couldn't have met her while she was...
I didn't meet her, no, just...
Anyway, you could have met one of the Strachys, you think, while you were writing
certainly.
The book.
Yes, certainly. And she was, I think I must just turn to the Snob's book to remember what her name, the Children's Governess.
Oh, she's Philippa was.
I think that's right.
Was she really? Well, she was right in the thick of the non-militant, the Fawcett Society, you know, the,
yes,
the continuous...
Yes, they indeed. I did a lot with the society and... There was a woman in those days called Vera Dewey.
That's right.
I think she's still alive.
She's still alive. She lives in Oxford, yeah.
Oh, she lives in Oxford. She's simply charming. And she was an enormous help to me. But, of course, then again, they've got... their library has been very much improved since my day. It was not...
Yes. You didn't have any direct contact with Sylvia, did you? Because she was alive, of course.
She was alive, but in Abyssinia, I think.
Yes, that's right, yes. She didn't write to you, or you didn't write to her about it, did she?
No, she didn't. I had been
Marjorie?
There. Marjorie, yes.
Oh, yes.
And I think also I saw... I'm sure I saw Philippa, yes.
And they rather influenced you towards
very
putting
much so.
The non-militant
yes.
line.
Yes.
That's very interesting. Because you combine, you do a very good job in the book, it seems to me, to combine respect for the courage of Mrs. Pankhurst and the militants with criticism of their tactics. You can have your cake and eat it if you're clever, and I think you do in that book. You see, I don't think the book is partisan particularly. I mean, you give praise to all parties in different ways, don't you? I mean, and you give criticism to all parties in different ways. I don't think it's an unfair book at all.
Do you remember whether hunger striking and all that, is it true that the Russians copied it from the suffragettes?
I don't honestly know. I think the suffragettes allegedly got it from them, didn't
yes.
they, via Tolstoy and Russian intellectual influences. But whether it goes back again to Russia, I don't know. but I mean, it seems to be influenced by Russian precedents, doesn't it? I'd be interested to know. I don't know. I mean...
part of this book is the biographical index at the end.
I don't agree with you.
Well, the point being that an awful lot of these people would have been untraceable now. Yeah. You know, the Obscura.
Yes.
Of course, Mrs. Biddington Gregg was really more than Women and the Machine, 1913. If you look at that, she was... Yeah.
She was a very interesting woman. I mean, that is the book that all the undergraduates read, Dangerfield.
I know. And I'm ashamed to tell you that I reviewed that book for the New Statesman years ago.
Mm.
I think it was not terribly enthusiastic about it. Mm.
Well, I don't think it was a very good book.
It's now, as you say, the time the Bible had begun. But I noticed that... he wrote a rather flattering review of this thing of mine. He's
Did
in
he?
America, I think, yes.
Yeah. That's very interesting. I mean, but you don't remember having been influenced by it yourself.
No, I certainly was not, because I must have either lost it during the war or sold it.
Mm. Mm. One other thing, one last question I wanted to ask you was, whether you actually encountered women in politics very much as a candidate yourself in 1929 or 1945. I mean, whether you got any view about the outcome of woman suffrage, so to speak, from your own experience. Because it seems to me one of the reasons why, one of the puzzles seems to me to be why woman suffrage doesn't lead to really extensive changes in the position of women in society, which, you know, the advocates of it thought would be the consequence of the vote, and which now are beginning to come about. I mean, you know, after an interval, there's this curious hiatus, isn't there? And I wonder whether, because you were active in politics during that hiatus, whether you got any view about why there was a hiatus, if you see what I mean.
I think they were, that on the whole, of course, the women MPs were a very disappointing crew. It was a disaster that... Lady Astor got in. A disaster, in my opinion.
Why?
Well, I mean, she was a mountebank, really. And made the whole thing slightly ridiculous. Mm. The first one of all, as you know, was that Irish Countess. Was
Markovitz, yes.
A fine character.
Mm. Mm.
But then it's supposed that she only went once to the House of Commons to look at her pig. See her name. And of course the second one was a liberal, Mrs. Wintringham, was a very much more serious. But I would have said of those earlier ones that Eleanor Rathbone was the, I suppose you would include Ellen Wilkinson, but in a sort of, from the point of view of converting people to women in Parliament, I think someone like Rathbone was quite outstanding myself.
Yes, especially a marvellous woman.
And they were a disappointing crew, weren't they?
Yes, they were, really. So you'd explain it partly in terms of just personality, that is, the people who put themselves forward.
Yes, and the fact, of course, that particularly the Conservatives, you know, always said, of course, we are in favour of women in Parliament, but a woman wouldn't do here. No, it's always a catchphrase.
That's right. Do you think there's anything in this sort of argument as well, that the campaign for women's suffrage is a sort of extension of liberalism in a way? It's the ultimate of liberalism, or it's certainly a prolongation of 19th century franchise extension and all that, which is the essence of liberalism in a way. And we all know what happened to the Liberal Party after 1918 or 1916, so that a lot of the feminists, in a sense, back the wrong horse from the point of view of immediate political influence.
Mm.
People like Mrs. Corbett Ashby, for instance.
Yes. I met her the other day, in 1992, or don't you?
Did you really?
Well, she came to a dinner at the National Liberal Club, I think in our honour, really, and I know I made a little oration.
Mm.
And I said something, this would be about 4 years ago, to the effect that the emancipation of women, the vote and all the rest of it, was the greatest revolution through which we'd lived, you see, and she very warmly endorsed this, which I think is correct, don't you, really?
Yes. I mean, you're more in a position to say that, but I think it is one of the most interesting developments.
And that, of course, is why one so regrets that the thing is out of balance. The history of it is rather, in my opinion, out of balance.
I agree. But
Eleanor Rathbone had put an hour in Brevin, absolutely put him down in silence to her.
Yes. Yeah, she was flippant. I think you're amusing without being flippant, if you see what I mean. I don't find it at all unsatisfactory, that side of it.